Okay, we are recording as we speak, and I'm just going to leave that on there. Now, this part of the interview, you know, will be taken off, so I'm going to read something into it at the moment. It's 1 p.m. on a Tuesday. The calendar date is January 7th, 2014, Serbian Christmas. On this tape, you'll hear stories of Ross Bosworth Aiken. Occasionally, you'll hear my voice, Keith Sweet. We are taping this at Ross's home in Jackson. We are also may also hear the voice of Pat Brown, a longtime family friend. Thank you, Ross, for participating in Amador County's Living History Project. We appreciate your willingness to preserve our county's history by sharing some of your memories. As you know, this conversation is being tape recorded, and the tapes will be made available to the public free of charge. If you share something during the next hour that you regret saying on the tape, we will make every effort to remove it before we put it up on the internet. So, thank you very much for allowing me to come into your home today. We have to remember while we're talking that this isn't going to be read by anybody. It's going to be listened to. And so a lot of times I'm going to ask you maybe to spell a name so that if anybody is doing some research later, they would like to know, you know, the correct spelling of that. And also, part of our intent is to get not only your history, but also your family's history and background, so how it was or that you became, you know, a child of Amador County, so to speak. So why don't I take you back to when your first family relatives on both your father's side and your mother's side came to the United States and to Amador County. And tell me a little bit if you know how they got here and how they traveled, and if you recall that. Their names, I know you mentioned that your grandmother came, had a family with five sisters, and then your father came later on, father's family came. So I'll leave it up to you. Tell me something about your grandmother's venture to the United States.
I know they came over here when they were young people. And he was a laborer in the mine, Argonaut, the Argonaut mine. And as I said, he got hurt.
This is your grandfather we're talking about?
My grandfather.
And his name was?
I never saw my grandmother or grandfather. I mean, my grandfather, either side. Louis, I think it was called him Luigi. Louis Benieski. And when he got hurt, he couldn't go back into the mines anymore. And they got a boarding house on the, I can't remember the name of the road, goes up the hill, Vogentol Road, yeah, right at the turn on the Vogentol Road at the bottom of the hill there. And they were there for a number of years until my grandmother insisted that he quit being such a joyful man and drinking with his customers that they sold the place and moved to San Francisco. And they were in San Francisco and the earthquake and fire hit. And in fact, she didn't find him for a week or more after that. The soldiers got him, and he refused at first to dig, he called ditches, to bury the dead. He came in with a big black eye, where he got a rifle butt in the head.
So they commandeered the civilians to help out.
Yeah, they commandeered the civilians to dig the graves, temporary or permanent, I don't know what they were, in San Francisco. And, of course, she had a lot of relatives up here. My mother was back and forth. My dad graduated University of California Dental School in 1898. And he practiced 1 year at the School of the Blind in Oakland. And 1900, he moved to Jackson and opened an office of dentistry in Jackson. My father did.
Do you know where that office was? Where was that office in Jackson?
I couldn't tell you. It was on Main Street, but where, he never did say. And after a few years, he got, I'd say, tangled up with mining, and he and his friends in San Francisco that had a lot of money, they took over the was called the Reed and Askey Mine from up about by Pine Grove and called it the Climax Mine.
Okay.
And they were mining there, and he said it was real good. When the earthquake and fire hit San Francisco, it collapsed the collar of the shaft in the mine, and you couldn't go down the mine anymore.
So the earthquake in San Francisco collapsed the mine in Pine Grove.
That's right. And his partners in San Francisco didn't want to invest any more money into it, and he alone couldn't do it, so they just abandoned it.
Do you know about where that mine was located in Pine Grove?
The Climax? Right. Yeah, it's on the Climax Mine Road, you know. Okay. That first sharp turn coming from Jackson up, it's right in there.
Okay.
And near the upper end of the road.
Right, okay.
And Dad, going back and forth, met my mother in San Francisco. And one thing led to another, and they got married. And he reopened his office of dentistry here in Jackson.
Do you remember offhand the year they were married?
Boy. No, I honestly don't.
Okay. Now, your mother's name, maiden name, was?
Marguerite Bagnieski.
How do you spell the last name?
Bagnieschi.
Okay. Now, she was one of how many daughters? Or one daughter? Any brothers?
Brother died.
Now, your grandmother, Bagnieschi, had how many? She had four sisters, did you tell me?
Well, there was five sisters. There was Del Womany, Marcucci, Giannini. Oh, I can't remember the other one. There was one that I never did hear or see much of. She moved and was down below in the Bay Area.
Now, all of those.
There was a bunch of them, anyway.
All of those are names of streets in Jackson.
is that what happened?
Yes, they are.
Well, Marcucci had the Broadway Hotel.
Okay.
There, which is now an apartment building.
Right.
They did. And where the end of. The motel is now, that motel down below in...
The Amador Inn?
Is it the Amador Inn?
Right.
There was a little house right on the corner of South Avenue and Broadway that my mother lived in when she was a little girl. They demolished that and built that motel all through there. My father came up here in 1900, as I said, and opened that office. And then when they came back, when they got married, I was born in San Francisco, but I was brought right back up here, and I was about 2 or 3 years old, and we moved to Stockton. And we were down there until 32, and everybody was coming down. They didn't have a dentist here, and they were coming down to him down there and kept telling him to come back up. We need a dentist. So he started back up a couple of days a week and got so busy that we moved back up in 1932.
Now, so for our listeners, they should know that you were born in 1918, and your 96th birthday will be coming up fairly soon.
Yeah, I was born 1918. And
so you had a lived shortly in Sacramento, or in Stockton, but
Stockton for
10-12 years or so.
I was a freshman in high school when we moved back here. So I went through high school here, then I went to junior college in San Mateo.
But let me stop you there. In high school, how many were in your graduating class?
When I graduated in high school?
Right.
Oh, boy, there was one room classroom. There couldn't have been more than 35, 40 people to graduate. Let's see. There was only about 135 or 136 kids in the whole school at that time.
Did you play any sports when you were in high school?
Oh, yeah. I played football and basketball. And in fact, our last game of football, we beat Sutter Creek the first time in 9 years.
That sounds like my grandson. Just as an aside here, Amador beat Sutter Creek.
Well,
beat Jackson for the first time in 10 years.
This is the class members at his 90th birthday. She died shortly after, and she just recently died.
Can you identify them? The people in this picture? Now, while Ross, you're looking at that picture, I'll ask Pat. Now, Pat, you mentioned to me earlier that you met Ross when you were both sophomore. When you were a sophomore?
I was a sophomore in Yreka.
In Yreka.
Yeah. I graduated up there. My mother, my grandmother, her four kids, my four kids, were all born in Yreka. My great-grandfather came across on horseback and foot and landed in Portland and came down to Yreka to the Thompson gold diggings to mine for gold. But he decided it was too hard a work for what he was getting. So he started making bricks and digging cisterns. So most of the bricks on Minor Street are the Stockslager bricks
in Yreka. So your family settled in Yreka. You're settled here in Amador County. Any of those folks familiar to you still?
That's Bill Morrow, me. I can't make out these others. Ruth, Ruth Vintagro was my first girlfriend. I can't make them out anymore.
This is, what was your name, Kirkpatrick?
Oh.
Lives out there by...
Is that who that is?
By Perkles?
Yeah.
She died soon after. Class of 1936.
They all came to your 90th birthday. So, you graduated from high school, and then you went to San Mateo. Now, how did you end up going to college in San Mateo?
Well, I had an aunt that lived in San Mateo. One lived in San Jose, and one lived in San Mateo. And San Mateo JC was there, and I went there and stayed with my aunt. I did. Then I came home and worked for Chickasaw's store out there.
Sure.
For Jamie Chickasaw, I worked for him. Was it about 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, for $50 a month?
Wow. Now, you called him Jamie. His name was James.
Yeah.
But he went by Jamie? I mean, is that what people call him?
Well, I guess the people that really knew him or his family called him Jamie. Chickasaw, James Chickasaw.
Was he a pretty hard-driving individual?
No, he was easy. Well, I was young, and you know how that is.
How many years did you work for the Chickasaw store?
Not long. I worked for him for about a year or so, and then I got a job with the Bank of America, and we were very good friends of Fred Ferrajaro, which was about the third or fourth employee that A.P. Giannini hired on the streets of San Francisco when he started his bank, Bank of Italy. And we were very good friends with them, and he was manager of the Oakland main office. So I got a job down there at Oakland, Maine, night bookkeeper for one of the branches in that area. They'd bring the books in, and we'd post them and then send them back to the branch the next morning. And then he was promoted to head of all financing of the Bank of America in San Francisco. And, of course, he drugged me over there, so I was out of main office. They put me on what they called utility. I went 2 weeks here, 2 weeks there, 2 weeks here. I was taking vacation time. I was doing vacation time for the guys that were on permanent there, you know.
And you were how old about at this time, and you were still single?
I was still single. And I just got tired of that, and I quit. And I went to work in San Francisco for a cousin. It was a maintenance outfit. And that's when I married. I met Marie on one of these 2 weeks deals, you know. And
Marie is your first wife.
Yeah.
And her maiden name was?
Well, her name was Marie Pine.
Okay.
And we got married in San Francisco, and I was working for the outfit when Uncle Sam says, "I want you." Also, it was about the third or fourth time they said that. They kept kicking me back. They didn't want me after they found out I had an injury to my foot. And I went in the Army.
And what year was that?
1942. And I was in the Army 1942 to 1946. I was.
Let me stop you there. During the Depression, you were in Oakland working for the bank at that time, or was that, or were you still in high
school? Now what, the Big Depression? I was only about 3 years old. When the Big Depression hit, I was about 10, 12, something like that.
Right, you've been 12 or 13 years old.
Yeah.
Right. And you were living
in Stockton.
You were in Stockton.
That's when they kept coming down from here and going to Dad and wanting him to move back up. And he started this one-day business or two-day business, and it got so busy that we just moved back up.
And even during the Depression, your father was successful, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, he made a living. Yeah. He did. In fact, at one time he was going one day to Linden because the people out there didn't have a dentist. And one day a week he'd go from Stockton to Linden. I remember sitting in his lap steering the 1925 Nash, and he running the gas and shifting.
Any stories about patients and did they pay by cash all the time, or did he take...
That's probably cash. I didn't pay much attention to his business. I was just too young a kid.
Right. I know some people at that time, would bring in a chicken, or they would bring in some corn.
Yeah. I saw that come in. Yeah. After the Depression hit.
Right.
Some of the farmers brought in stuff, food and stuff. They couldn't pay their bill.
So you were drafted and you were in the Army. Where did you do in the Army?
Well, they found out that I couldn't wear high Army shoes like they originally thought. And they stuck me in 9th Service Command. And I did a number of things in 9th Service Command. I was in the Medical Corps. I was in the engineers before that, and then they put me in the MPs, and we had prisoners of war interrogation center down here at Byron Hot Springs, where we brought the Germans and the Japs in and interrogated them for information for bombing and stuff like that over there. In fact, we got the information from some of the Japanese where to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or the A-bomb, from there.
Now, these were prisoners of war. They were taken prisoner where?
Taken prisoners of war, and they were brought over here.
So they were...
And interrogated.
Okay, they were taken prisoner in the South Pacific, and then... Brought back over here, and then you
and the Japanese in South Pacific and the Germans in Germany and Europe, they were.
This was in Berrien Springs, did you say?
Hmm?
This was in Berrien Springs. Where were the prisoners kept?
Oh, we were. We had a camp down at Byron Hot Springs. That's about 15 miles, I'd say, west of Stockton.
Okay.
It was a little teeny place. There was an old, years and years ago, they made a hot springs resort out of it. They had some hot springs there. And they had a big... 3 or 4 story hotel, brick hotel, that was a prisoner compound. And then we had our buildings outside of that we lived in. And they had swimming pools of hot water and mud baths and all that stuff out there if you wanted to do it. I looked at the mud bath and I said, nah, I'm not going in that thing.
So how many prisoners at a time would you say might have been there?
Oh, they had 30-40
okay.
prisoners at a time. They'd call up from San Francisco and say, "We got a prisoner for you." And we'd say, "Okay, we'll be down in a day," or "We'd be down in 4 hours." We never told them, you know, just how many hours before we'd get there. They didn't know where we were. And I'd go down and pick the prisoner up and bring him back to the compound. And then interrogators were there. They put them in a room, which is a prison. They made into a prison, all of them. And we had one German come in, and he looks around in Germany. He said, "Oh, microphone." The place was just covered with mics, you know. You could pick up a pin drop, you know, and all over the place. And down in the basement, we didn't have tape in those days, but they had these great big platters, these, like the old-fashioned phonograph thing,
right.
Running slowly all the time, going around, picking up every little word or sound and everything down there.
And what was your responsibility in this facility?
What was mine? Well, mine went first was I was the electrical engineer, you might as well call it, for all the electricity, electrical stuff in there. I didn't do any. We had in the Japanese, we had the Nisi boys from that most decorated outfit in Europe of Japanese Americans. They were interrogated the Japanese. They did.
So after that stretch in the military, then what did you do?
And then when the war was over, before that, they transferred all of us to Angel Island in San Francisco. And we had POWs there we guarded. I was in the MPs and I was a guard. And I was scheduled to go over to Okinawa with a whole pile of them when I got sick. And they shipped me to the hospital and my ship left without me. When I got back, I said, "Hey, Sarge, what am I going to do?" He says, "Hey, I thought you were discharged." I says, no. He says, "Go in your bunk and lay down." He says, "I'll call you." About 2 days later, he calls me and says, "Hey, here's papers. Go over to Stoneman. You're being discharged." So I went to Stoneman, from Stoneman to Marysville. In Marysville, I was discharged and sent home.
So now you're back in Jackson.
And when I got out, I says, "I am not raising my kids in that rat race in San Francisco." I had one daughter at the time. And she was born about 6-8 months before I was discharged from the Army. Or maybe a little longer than that. I'm not quite sure on that part. So I came back to Jackson.
And your daughter's name was?
Yes. Pardon?
Your daughter's name?
The one that, the first one?
Right.
Was Sandra Tollett. Okay. Over here, lives next door here.
And you spell last name is spelled how?
Pardon?
Her last name is spelled how?
Tollett.
Okay.
You weren't here when John had the wrecking yard here. John Tollett?
No.
All that property, practically from, the beginning of the shopping center that's up there on top of the hill, Martell, all across that, on the other side of the road, was a wrecking yard. That whole business, all the way to what's the name of the road that goes to Walmart?
Wickham?
Huh?
Wicklow?
Wicklow Way, all the way from Wicklow Way up to the other end of where the buildings start, was all wrecking yard at one time. John Tollett, my son-in-law.
That was across, on Highway 88, across the street from where Strings is now?
Yeah.
Would have been on the north side of Highway 88.
Yeah, all the way up to the other building. Well, there was one building they tore down. That was the substation for gasoline station.
They just recently took a lot of that away.
Yeah.
Right? That's okay.
So, and then I had another daughter, Jacqueline, and she married Hemingway from Pine Grove. They're up in Oregon. And then the youngest daughter married her school teacher down here, Romero, and they're in Pine, in Oregon.
And Romero's first name?
Patricia.
Patricia.
And her husband's name?
Edward.
Yeah.
Okay. So you moved back. Where did you move back? Where did you live when you moved back to Jackson?
We moved back to Jackson. We moved in with my folks that were on, it was the old highway going through town. What's the name of the street?
Sutter Street?
Comes.
Broadway?
Court Street?
Is it Court that comes out of, from National Hotel and goes straight?
Water Street. All
right.
Water becomes Court.
All right. Right at the turn of Water Street, after you pass the beginning of Pitt Street, there's two houses in there. They were living in one house, and we moved in with them. And then Kennedy Mine, we knew the what do you call it? I guess he'd be the manager or the Kennedy Mine property and all that. And they started selling property. And Sheriff Luco wanted a lot out here. And we heard he was going to extend their street out. So we asked him, he's a friend of Dad's, and he said, sure, you can have the second choice. Well, they extended it out. They cut these two lots, one there and one here.
And we're talking Pitt Street.
On Pitt Street, and extended the street out another 200 feet. And when they did that, Luca says, no, I want the lot up there on the hill. It was way over there where that first oak tree is. And Mark says, no. So he says, what lot do you want, Ross, or Dad? And I said, well, I want the upper one. The one below is too close to the creek. So we took the upper one, and I built this duplex. Folks were supposed to live in the front, and we were to live in the back. We moved in, and Marie had Jackie right after we moved in.
So what were you doing at this time?
I was doing nothing. I wasn't feeling well, and I was doing carved leather. I was making leather purses, women's purses, and there was a good market on those I was getting almost $100 a piece for them or more. And I was making carved leather purses. So,
and how did you pick up that trade?
How did I pick up that trade? Well, actually, it's so long ago, I'm not quite sure. But I believe I did when I was in the No, that isn't when it was. I was going to say I was in the hospital in the Army. It had to be, though. I was in the hospital at one time or another sometime through there that I picked it up when I was in the hospital. Anyway.
So you came back to Jackson with your family, and you built this duplex. Now, your father's home was next door or
no,
further up the hill?
This was a big vacant lot, 200 by 200. And I built this here. And like I said, they were supposed to move in the front. I was supposed to move in the back. Dad passed away before they moved in. My mother moved in later and lived in it for a while till she passed away. And after I built this, I got a job. Yeah, I started in carpentry. That's when I started back to carpentry. And I started building after I built this house. And I got a job with a couple of carpenters here in town. And we built a couple of big houses up on the hills over here. And it just kind of went from there. And I got tangled up with two young kids that wanted the block plant out here. We had a concrete block plant out here, you know, where those apartments are at the corner of
Clinton and Broadway?
By the DMV office.
Right.
Clinton Road and Mission Boulevard. There was a block plant there. So, I don't know, I backed them a couple of $1,000 or so. And one of them didn't exactly like it. He didn't do much work, so we bought him out rather cheap. And the other one, he worked with me for about a year or so making block out there. And then I finally bought him out. And I had what they call the Butte Block and Building Supply out there on the corner of the road. And I was busy out doing work, and Marie took care of the store when I was out and working. And we just went along like that for a while, and finally.
Besides concrete block, what kind of building supplies were you selling?
The guy that owned the property, I went to him a couple of times and wanted to buy it because I was leasing the property, you know, with all this building and equipment on it. And he's, "No, Ross," he says, "if I sell it, I'll let you know." Okay. Next thing I knew, this other guy comes in and he says, "I want you removed from the property. I bought it." I was working full time by then, carpentry. I just threw up my hands and I let it go. And I didn't take anything from there. He sold the stuff. Actually, it was my stuff, but he sold it.
So did the business continue? Did he continue the business?
No,
or
no.
The business stopped.
It stopped.
About what time, what year was that?
That's when they built the apartments out there and things. And I was working at Silver Lake. Then I got working with Earl Ware. He had a little resort on Kirkwood Lake. And we were both carpenters, and we got so busy up there as a pair that I think we worked on every house on Silver Lake, Cables Lake, Bell River, or built a new one, or did something to every house that's up there.
Now, you, just to go back just a little bit, you were making leather carved purses, got the feeling better, and you became a carpenter. Now,
yeah, that's when I started building this house.
Did you have a contractor's license?
No, I never had a contractor's license. I'll tell you one little story. In the 1950s, the county of Amador hired me to remodel the upstairs of the museum because the roof had leaked so bad that it had ruined everything upstairs and almost everything downstairs. They put a new roof on it, and they hired me to fix the upstairs of the museum. I tore all the plaster and lathing out of it and dumped it and hauled it away. And that's when I told them at that time that the floor joists were coming out of the pockets of the wall. Oh, that was all right. Suddenly, later on, they closed the museum and everything, and they wouldn't let anybody in it. Well, I put sheetrock all inside, taped it and textured it, painted it, put a new floor down, all that linoleum floor, and the whole upstairs down, up there. Then, how are they going to get upstairs? The only race they had was that little corner where those stairs are, those steep stairs.
Right.
On the other side of that room was a big display case with nothing but Indian artifacts, arrows and all that stuff. And that was the only spot in the whole house that they could put a stairway up. And it was red, soft red brick. You could almost crumble the brick.
Still can.
Huh?
You still can.
Well, okay. I believe I lined it with sheetrock. Believe it or not, I nailed sheetrock on those brick and textured it there and painted it. And I run those stairs up in that corner the best I could. There was no place else to put them.
So the curved stairs that are there now, you built those?
I built those. They're steep.
They are steep.
There was no place else. I had no room at all.
Now, just to go back a second, where was the original staircase to get to the second floor?
There, where that one was.
In that spot, okay.
Yeah. That was the only place.
So it all needed to be rebuilt.
Mm-hmm. So I did all that in the museum.
What, do you remember what year that was?
It was back in the 50s. I don't know exactly when it was. And there was a contractor in town here. He had a license. Ianni, his name was. And he wanted the job. Well, I got the job. And he reported me to the contractors board in Sacramento. Well, they came up. They went to Caminiti, who was judge at the Superior Court judge at the time. And he said they wanted a warrant for my arrest. Caminiti looks at him and he says, if you want a warrant for the arrest of Ross Aiken, he says, you get it out of Sacramento. I'm not giving you one. So Cam was a pretty good guy. So the thing was, I never billed a thing to Ross Aiken. Everything was billed directly to the county on materials. Labor was hourly labor, which was billed as hourly labor. I was a hired employee of the Amador County, and all equipment, stuff was was billed to them. That's how I built the museum, fixed the museum up.
Remember how long that job took?
No, I don't. I really don't.
But your primary occupation while you were, before you retired, was carpentry?
Carpentry. Oh, I did masonry, carpentry, plumbing, all that stuff. We did the whole thing, electrical, anything. It came up, we did it all.
When did you retire?
When did I retire? I retired when I couldn't work anymore.
That's kind of the way it is for a lot of people.
I quit carpentry. I quit carpentry and went into cutting lawns.
So you stayed busy as long as you could.
Yeah.
What, when you were I guess the question I was going to ask is, what kind of changes do you see on Main Street, you know, when it was in its heyday, shall we say, I'm going to say in the 40s. I know you mentioned, or Pat mentioned earlier, you could name what buildings you built and who worked where.
In the 40s, there was Casinelli's store, which is a big German general merchandising store, had three buildings just above Sausman's Garage. Now, Sausman's Garage was that brick facade thing where the pawn shop is. You know where the pawn shop is?
Right.
All right, that was a big driveway. You went into Sausman's Garage, you went all the way through to the back. There was no highway in back out there. And back out there, he washed cars. He did all kinds of stuff out in the back. But that was Sausman's Garage.
This was George Sausman.
George Sausman. And then next to that was Casinelli's store, 1, 2, 3. Grocery store, furniture store, appliance store there. Across the street, where Safeway was, Sammy's Cafe. Next to that was Joe Valvo's barber shop. He had a four-chair barber shop in there. He did. And then there was the Louvre Cafe. Next to that, and there was something connected to the Louvre there. And then next to that, there was Cugno's menswear. Cugno's menswear. Is there another one? Another thing before Briscoe's drugstore was on the corner. I helped John Gubbins, the contractor, remodel that store on the corner. And he used to have a big thing that hung out over the sidewalk with bay windows in it and a round roof with a big pinnacle up on top. And I tore that pinnacle and all that stuff off as a kid. I was a kid then when that happened. This was years before. And I designed the front of that store for John Gubbins. He did. And then
now what do you know what's
Dave
there?
Steve Onetto plastered the front of it. It was a brick building. Plastered the front and plastered the whole side of the building. He did.
Now do you know what works in there now? Do you know what's in that building now?
No, it's right over there on the corner.
Is it on the corner of Court Street?
Court Street.
Okay, right on the corner of Court Street. Okay.
It was a drugstore for years and years. It did. Then straight across the street from the drugstore, there used to be another barber shop. It had a two-seater barber shop. Then there was a little house that set back in there. A little lady lived in it. Right on Main Street, the house. And it had a little iron fence across the front of it. And then it came Love's Hall, where we used to dance back there in the back, Love's Hall. And then it came down there. We're back to Casanelli's again. We're back in there. In that area there, that was there. And then below Sausman's, there was a building that I can't remember what was there, but there was an alley, and after the alley there was a building that the Western Auto used to be in. And then there was, of course, Smalley's Garage down at the end. Then the National. And those buildings alongside the National, they're vague to me. There were in and out people, as I call it. Then right on the corner, the post office. The post office was right there on the corner of, as it turned and went out Broadway.
And then across from that was a gas station.
And across from that was Standard Oil gas station. Standard Oil. That was the only gas station we had in town, I believe. Besides, there was one up at the upper end, too. I forget that one. And alongside of the gas station, there was a tire shop. Recaps and retires and all that stuff. It's a parking lot now. And then, of course, the old bar across the street there. And there was a restaurant behind the bar.
We're on Water Street now?
Yeah. I'm coming back up Main Street. A restaurant behind the bar. And then there was a little store. Now I think it's a little confectionery place now in there. Then there was Al Vila's Sporting Goods there. And then there was Sammy's, or where Safeway first came into Jackson, Sammy's Cafe. Then there was Joe Valvo, and we went up to collected that. And that's all the whole south end of Jackson, from Court Street down.
Now, you didn't mention the Fargo. You didn't mention the Fargo. What was it?
Wells Fargo.
No, the Fargo Bar and Restaurant.
Fargo Bar and Restaurant. Yeah, it was there. It's been there for years.
And when you went out Broadway behind the gas station and the tire shop, what was?
Oh,
what
there was also a gas station and a garage behind the Wells Fargo there, across from that was an Associated station. It had two pumps and Rule. The Rule brothers run that station and the garage, repair garage and that.
Where was the police station? Was it in one of those buildings next to the National?
You know, I don't know where the police station was, unless it was up in the courthouse with the sheriff. Because there was a post office, and you go out Broadway across the bridge, there was a little teeny, I believe it was a little store there, and then there was Jackson Lumberyard, where the courthouse, where the city hall is now. That was Jackson Lumberyard. Across the street from that, there was a bar first, next to the creek, and then there was the Ford Garage. Charlie Gorman had the Ford Garage next to that, and I think there was an auto parts place before you got to Charlie Gorman's. There was the bar, auto parts, and then Charlie Gorman Ford Garage.
This is all before the creek?
This is on the other side of the creek. On this side of the creek.
Okay.
Then from there on, there was houses on both sides.
Some of those houses were interesting. Some of those houses were interesting.
Some of those houses were what?
Some of those houses near the creek up behind what is now Pekovich Park were houses of prostitution, were they not?
Oh, the houses of prostitution were behind, where the parking lot of the Bank of America is. There was two there. You could enter one by that bar. There was an alley there right by the side of that bar on I mentioned, and then there was another alley between whose garage was it? It was the garage. I don't know the name of the people that have it now, but down on Water Street. There was a little teeny brick place that used to be a bar, and alongside of that,
Brown's Garage,
there was a bridge across the creek there to get to them. And then the one behind Salzman's, way back there, I don't know, I guess you could go through the garage or anything to get to that one. There was one where Melon Faze is.
Right.
There was one there. Then there was a place called the Mexican one. That was right up where the firehouse is, right where the highway goes through. There was.
Where the Jackson firehouse is now?
Where the Jackson firehouse is now, alongside of that. In other words, the highway. That's where that one was.
Do you remember it when they put that highway in the 50s? Was there a lot of anxiety about that, or discussion about that, or concern that was going to?
No,
be going
I was young. I didn't pay much attention to it, but they were all, I think, kind of happy that it was going through. Because congestion was getting so bad on that narrow street in Jackson, it was terrible.
And the lumber trucks would have a very difficult time making that turn on Broadway and Water Street there.
They couldn't get through. They didn't. Lumber trucks had to come down Ridge Road. They did. So, and the folks were going we were living. My last year of high school, we were living in that house right alongside of Highway 88 after you turn and start to go up. That house that sits right there, kind of high.
Catty corner from Bank of America.
Oh, okay, sure.
we were living in that house, and Dad was going to buy it, and then we found out the highway was going to go through, and he didn't. But it took out a house below us to put the road through. It did.
Now, did you build any other homes here on Pitt Street?
Pardon?
Did you build any other homes here on Pitt Street?
Did I build any homes on Pitt Street? No, I didn't build any homes on Pitt Street. In fact, the only work I ever did on Pitt Street was for Marie Louise.
Marie Louise Szilagyi.
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. The old Kirkwood house that Kirkwoods lived in the summertime, I mean the wintertime, across from the Taylor house on the corner of what's the street goes up the hill?
Bright.
Is that Bright that goes up the first road here? Goes mm-hmm. up?
Right.
At the corner of Bright. The one on the other side was the Kirkwood house. The one on this side was Warren Taylor's house. He married a Kirkwood girl. That's when he built that house. And there was a fire went through the Kirkwood house. And I tore half of it down that was burnt and made a small apartment out of the front half. So I worked on that house.
Now, the name Kirkwood is familiar, obviously, because we've got Kirkwood
yes,
Ski
Kirkwood.
Resort and so forth. Did they own all that property up there? Is that...
You mean up...
Up the mountain?
Yeah, Kirkwood, yeah, they owned all the property up there. Yeah. I don't know whether I did anything for McLaughlin's or not.
He helped Sandra and Dennis build their house.
Well, I helped them. I built their house, not most of it. I didn't build it all, but I built most of it. I was working in the hills then, and they had another friend that was a carpenter that came up occasionally and helped them.
We've talked almost an hour now, and I've enjoyed it. I know that you've got a lot more to tell, and maybe we can continue later on. But before we finish today, I do, as a city councilman, do want to have you mention about your wife Marie. Tell me a little bit about how she became involved in city politics and then county politics.
Well, I really don't know how she became involved. But she run for supervisor at District 1 and won the position. And,
do you remember who she ran against?
No, I don't. But they were all men. And she was the first woman supervisor for Amador County. And she had, I believe, two terms or so. In the third term, Angela DiPaoli's wife, I can't remember her name. There's two women running, and she beat Marie out by just a few votes. But she died before she could take office. And they appointed Angelo to take her place. So Marie was the first woman supervisor of Amador County. Our man, I can't think of his name right now. What is it? It's supposed to be a historian for Amador County.
Larry Sonato.
Sonato. See, Sonato came up here when Marie was Stringer reporter for the Sacramento Bee, and he wanted to be Stringer reporter. So the two of them were at each other's throat And then they never did get along. And then finally Marie gave it up for, I guess it was for this job, and he went on, he became reporter for the Sacramento Bee. And I understand the last I heard that he put Angelo's wife as first woman supervisor, which is a lie. If you can get it straightened out, I'd appreciate it to get straightened out.
I'll look
the records will show it anyway. And then after she lost that job, of course, she liked politics, I guess, and she was always in it. And she ran for city council. And she was city councilwoman for her district here until she had the heart attack and passed away.
Did she enjoy being a supervisor? Did she have any particular troubles, any issues that you can recall?
No, she was too much politics for me. She got me to run for
school board?
A county board of education, and I won. I was in there for, I believe, about two terms, and I got this job in Oregon. My daughter got me a good job in Oregon, so I resigned my position as in the
Board of Education.
Board of Education. So, I stayed out of politics. She was in politics. She loved politics. She made me so mad sometimes. She came up to see me. I was working at Silver Lake, and I had a brand new GMC pickup, and she came up. She had an old Dodge. Jerry, I'm not Governor
Ronald Reagan. Reagan?
Yeah, Governor Reagan had appointed her on the board of a mental hospital, and she was going to Stockton for a meeting, for a state meeting, the board of mental hospital. And she decided she didn't want to take the old car down there. It didn't look too good. So she said, let me take the pickup. So she took the pickup, and she had her dress on the seat. She was going to stop here and put it on and go on. And coming down, it started to slide off the seat, and she reached over to push it back up. When she came up, she was off the road, and she overcorrected and went across the road, over the bank, turned over, total the pickup. Wonder it didn't kill her. And she totaled my brand new pickup.
But she wasn't hurt?
She was banged up some and everything, but she was in the hospital for a couple of days, but nothing serious. Might have helped the heart attack later on, I don't know. Anyway. That's what happened.
She didn't make her meeting with Governor Reagan.
She never made the meeting in Stockton with the board of mental board. She never made that one anyway.
Well,
but she liked politics.
Maybe the next time I come back, we can talk some more about that and then finish up with your history here in town. But I want to thank you very much, Ross, for sharing with me today and. We'll do this again.
Okay. Was it 2,700 feet on a 60 degree angle?
Right.
Deep. It's over a mile deep in the ground, the Argonaut is.
And the Kennedy went straight down.
The Kennedy went down, went over, and went down. See, originally the Kennedy was right up next to the Argonaut up there on the lower side of the road. It was, you know, where you turn off
Right.
To go to the, it was right there. Well, they went down, and they got so far away from the ledge that they went over, way over there, and went down, hit the ledge, and went down straight. And when they got too far away, they went over again and down. They got had a hoist underground to hoist it up, bring it over, and then bring it to the surface. They did. And in 19, well, it was just about World War II, just before World War II, Kennedy was going to move over here, you know, where the restroom is on the corner of the Court Street.
Kit Carson.
Kit Carson. They were going to put a shaft down there, go over and hit the ledge there, come over here and pick up the Xylee mine, a lot of quartz, low-grade ore, and bring it together and bring it to the surface. And the war hit, and it all blew up. Emmett Gabarini, a friend of mine, was a contractor. Well, they were going to have him build a gallus frame or something. He was going to do something of the mine. I remember that. What it was exactly, I don't know. But he was all set to build a gallus frame there, and they were going to sink a shaft, go over, pick up the mine over there, and come over here and pick up this mine. See, because that ledge is right behind my house here, so it's just, it's on this side of the Mission Boulevard, the ledge is. You can see it in the creek down there. And it was a low-grade, large ledge. Today, it would probably be worth mining. But in those days, when gold was, what, $9, $12 or so an ounce, it wasn't too much of a good proposition. But they had a big shaft over there behind Billy Morrow's house. And they had a tram or steel across the Broadway. And they made a big dump where all those houses, that little subdivision alongside the creek over there. It would be behind...
Raley's?
No, it's right here. It's on.
Oh.
It's
on Bright Street.
It's that little. You go down Broadway and make the turn, and you go into that little subdivision there before you cross the creek.
Oh yeah, out by Buy and Sell.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's on the other side of the creek there. All that was when I was a kid was a big dump.
A tailings pile.
Greenstone. No tailing. This was a dump. Greenstone. And the counties and everybody else has took that all away and built roads with it. And then they put that little subdivision in there.
Now, where the greenstone was being dumped there, where were they taking it out of? Where was
out
it?
Of the Xylee mine.
Out of the mine, okay.
They used to have a thing across the road, like out Jackson Gate. They had a ditch that went across it. The tailings from the Kennedy would go across in a flume.
Right.
Across the road. I remember driving underneath it to the next wheel and on up. Well, they had a deal over here, but it wasn't a flume. It was some kind of a deal that whether they trammed it across or what, I can just barely remember it. But it was across the road there, and then the dump was all that whole area below Broadway to the creek. It was all full of gouge from the mine.
When you were driving out Jackson Gate and going underneath the Kennedy flume, the tail that went between the tailing wheels, did you know what was in those buildings?
There was no buildings.
There was no buildings.
Just wheels.
Because they took.
You could see the wheels
turning.
You could see the wheels slowly turning. They would.
This was after the mine closed, though.
No, this is mine was open. The mine was still running when I was a kid. It didn't close until Roosevelt closed in World War II.
Right. But they were all enclosed in sheet metal buildings, were they not?
No. I never saw a sheet metal building in any of them. Mm. Now, maybe some of them were, but I never saw them. And I know Emmett rebuilt number one, and because he took my boy that I used to have working for me.
Emmett Garbarini?
Yeah. And I didn't have any work at the time, and I let him go over. Emmett wanted him, so I said, go ahead and take him. And he and Emmett rebuilt number one wheel, but they made a big mistake. They didn't cover it. And I understand it's collapsed again.
Well, wheel number one at the moment is being held up with cables.
Well, it's still held up, though.
Right. And it looks, when people walk by it, as though it were okay. But if the cables get cut, the wheel will come down.
Yeah. Well, they rebuilt that wheel, and they left it out in the open after they rebuilt it. So I don't know. I don't know who had it rebuilt, whether it's... as I say, the Hysterical Society had rebuilt her.
Well, there was a group of people that raised some money, and this was in the early 70s.
Wasn't it before that?
I think it was the early 70s that they rebuilt it. They may have done it before that, but that's...
Done it before that. Yeah. I think it was before that. Can't think exactly.
Well, we could look it up. I understand that your family built a cabin up on Silver Lake.
And I... 1927. We got a lot in 1926. Dad knew the head ranger in Placerville. He came over and cut us a lot. It was the first lot on the north end of Silver Lake. It's the largest lot on the lake. It was. I think it still is. In 1927, we built a cabin, and every year after that, well, Mother and I rather lived up there. School was out, we were up there. Every weekend, we'd go up Silver Lake.
Now, at that time, you built this cabin. There were how many other cabins up there? Not many.
At that end of the lake, there was one cabin. Ours was the second cabin. He built a cabin without a lot, and they were going to make him tear it down and kick it off, kick him out. And when they cut a lot for Dad, then they went over and cut a lot around his house. And
now, these lots were not purchased, they were leased, right?
Pardon?
These lots were not purchased, they were leased?
They were a 99-year lease, which they're not now.
Hello. I should get tired of telemarketers.
Oh, yeah.
At that time, they were a 99-year lease, and I think we paid $20 a year. But the forest, you know, they changing things all the time. Now I think they're down to 5 and 3, and they pay several hundred dollars a year, I think they do.
So how many years did your family have that cabin then?
Well, we had it until World War II, and Dad couldn't go open it up, as we called it, because in wintertime, you know, you put storm windows on it and closed it all down. And he went and sold it, or practically gave it away, in World War II, 1943, I believe it was, somewhere in that, about 1943. And I've always intended to go up and see what it looked like, but I never got up there, and I guess I'm never going to know.
What are some of your favorite memories of being up there?
Oh, I don't know. I love to fish. I used to, like I say, I used to go down the stream and in a couple of hours come back with 25 trout. That was a limit at that time. Stream trout, 25. Or go out in the lake and catch 10 pounds and one fish. That was a limit in the lakes. You could.
So you've been a fisherman all of your life?
I love to fish, yeah. Fish and hunt.
So after you had got rid of the cabin up there, your family no longer had it, you continued to go up to Silver Lake all?
Oh, yeah. We'd go up there time after time and go fishing and what have you, you know.
I think you told me, and it may have been off tape, you built a lot of homes up there.
Yeah, I got to working with Earl Ware, which had the Kirkwood Lodge at Kirkwood Lake. And we, as a pair of carpenters, we worked on every house on Silver Lake, Cables Lake, Bear River, or built new ones, or moved them, or did something to just about every house on all those lakes.
Do you remember any of the names of the people who you worked for? Any of the people around Silver Lake that you worked on their home?
No, it's been so many years that I know
when you drive down there, there's a lot of signs on the trees, and there are a lot of familiar Amador County names.
Yeah. Well, that'd be Plass's end of the lake.
Right.
Yeah. Let's see, Plass's end of the lake was the first part of the housing that the government cut the lots up for. Was down there. There was about 12 or 13 houses down there, I think. And then when they started over at our end, the north end, then they rented out all the way clear around, halfway around the lake. And they put in a lot of lots and a lot of cabins down there.
When you were little, didn't you build a boat?
Oh, I built a rowboat for the family, for us. I guess I was a teenager, and stocked in a 16-foot rowboat that we used until we sold the cabin. It was.
Cabin went with the boat went with the cabin.
No, the boat went to some people down Highway 88. You know that apple orchard on Highway 88 up by where is it? Buckhorn.
Right.
Joyce's. Well, he bought it from Dad. In fact, it was down behind the barn for years there. I was almost tempted to go up and try to buy it back from him. I did one time. So,
Now, when you were going up to your cabin on Silver Lake, what was the road like? What is now Highway 88?
Well, you could figure when it first started out, it was a 2-hour drive. It was oiled, but it was a one-way road, really. There was places turn out that you could pass for passing cars. And up there, about 9 miles from the lake, the state had a summer camp for the highway people to work on the road. They had a camp way up there, too, which is no longer there. You know, the road that goes will go over to Placerville. I forget what they call that road. Anyway, from there, to Placerville, it's a road that the Forest Service has it. Anyway, they had a summer camp there for the highway people to work, so they didn't have to go up and down.
And you want to make sure you didn't drive up to Silver Lake when they were having a cattle drive.
One time we were, we'd have to honk, 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 honk to get through the cows. And early in the season, the cows were coming up, and maybe we were going back down to go to work or go to school or something, you know. And the cows would be coming up, and you'd have to honk, 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 and you get through the cows, or either going up, we'd do the same thing. They'd drive them up every year and drive them back every year. They did on the road. So
it made a big difference when they paved it then.
One time, early in the season, the little snow plow they had to plow the road early in the season broke down. It broke down about what we call the road camp, which is I just explained them. And we wanted to get into the cabin because next weekend or weekend after that, fishing season opened. And we were having people come up from below. Well, we drove up to the end of the road where they had it plowed and parked the car, and we walked from the road camp to the cabin, which was 9 miles over snow and everything. And then the next weekend, they had plowed it up as far as the top of the grade, which we had to walk about 2 or 3 miles to get to the cabin because the little snowplow hadn't opened it up.
You couldn't snowshoe in, huh?
Yeah. Well, I can remember, they're talking about high snow, driving through the snow, one lane of plow. You couldn't see out of the car. The snow was above the car. You couldn't see out because it's just all white. Driving through the snow,
the good old days.
Yeah, did they have somebody stopping people so that you could because it was a one way road.
No,
right?
They dug little places out, and if you met a car, you either backed up or they backed up to the spot they widened, and you passed. But I've gone up there at that time and maybe passed one, maybe two cars. That's all. The whole 50 miles. That's all.
So until it became a Highway 88, which is about what time frame was that?
It was a Highway 8 at that time.
Highway 8.
State Highway 8. It was. And then when I made it to 88, why? It gradually got better and better, and they put new pieces in here and new pieces in there. I remember the new piece they put in from Ham Station to the top of the hill to Silver Lake. Or just about there, Ham Station to... it was from Ham Station to the road camp, it was. And that was several years it took them to do that. because we were going up and down, and they made a beautiful road down below.
The new road's a lot easier than the old road.
Oh, was it? I got it down to about 55 minutes from Silver Lake to Jackson.
That's about what it takes now, even today, with all the traffic. Anyway, thanks, Ross.